coffee is good for you. No, wait, it's bad for you. Which one is it? Red wine. Well, it's good for you. Well, no, maybe it's not. Oh, yes, it is. Everywhere you look, there is a new study, a new opinion, and a new fad about health. So many of them that it's extremely difficult to know which study or person you can trust. Dr. Chana Davis says you need to be very careful about whom you trust. Check the source, check the funder, and determine if the research is peer-reviewed. Davis goes on to suggest you double-check the findings. Who else agrees? Does the FDA agree? What about the Canada Food Guide? And what about PubMed.gov? What do they have to say about it? It's easy to get swept up in the hype around diets. Your aunt, your uncle, and your mother's best friend may have all lost weight on a low-carb or high-protein diet. Davis says, well, that may be true. You don't know why. It may have been their strict adherence to the plan. It could be their particular metabolic makeup. In other words, anecdotal evidence isn't enough to make an informed decision about diet. We invited Dr. Davis to join us for a conversation that matters about where to find trustworthy information. One place for sure is on her new video podcast show, Get Real Health, on YouTube.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the following and viewers like you. Please become a patron at conversationsthatmatter.tv.
We get bombarded with information every day. This diet works, that diet doesn't work, on and on and on and on. How do I tell what is and isn't true?
There are many, many layers to that. I guess I'll just jump in. So the first layer, I would say, is looking at the source. So, you know, there are, you know, celebrity experts, I'd say, or, you know, random people who are not particularly well-informed would be one type of source, and unfortunately we see a lot of that.
Well, and some of them look pretty good, and I go, I want to look like you.
Yeah, I don't blame you. They are a very attractive package, but it doesn't go very deep in many cases, unfortunately. And then on the other side, you have, you know, maybe not as glamorous, but you have, you know, something like the World Health Organization, which is, you know, a massive organization that's not as glamorous, but will give you probably more conservative findings than something that, you know, a celebrity is going to suggest. Mm-hmm. So number one, differentiating information is to look at the source of the information.
Okay. So when you bring that up, I think, okay, well, the Canada Food Guide. Mm-hmm. And yet I watch the Canada Food Guide reverse itself on things at times, and I go, okay, well, if I can't, you know, rely on them, then where do I go?
That's a great point. So I would say, you know, I do put stock in something like the Canada Food Guide. I would say, I think that that's a reasonable, you know, very solid information source. But at the same time, you do have to be aware, you know, every information source does have agendas that are trying to shape it. So Canada Food Guide, you know, will have lobbies, you know, agriculture,
for example.
So starting with knowing the source and then just recognizing the potential biases. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I worked previously in drug development and pharmaceuticals at Genentech, and they developed cancer drugs. And so, you know, people might say, whenever I see a drug trial that came out positive for a cancer drug, I don't believe it because it came from the company. You can't just dismiss everything. You just have to be aware of the biases. So it's the same thing in the nutrition world. You can't dismiss everything that has, you know, smells of industry, because those people have the money to fund the work and the large studies that are so expensive to mm-hmm. do. Mm-hmm. But you just need to be aware of the biases and factor that in.
Huh. As you're saying that, I'm reminded about, I read a fascinating book called The China Study a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. And I believe within it, it started talking about, you know, why do we need protein? Mm-hmm. Like, what happens in the body that we need protein? And it was a German researcher in the 1800s that identified this loss of protein in our body as we move our way through the day, and said, well, you need to replace that protein. So you need to have some sort of source that's going to replace that protein. But the amount of protein that they indicated that was required was very small. Mm-hmm. But somewhere within 30 or 40 years, some, as you say, lobbying group went, well, no, maybe you should double it just to be safe. Mm-hmm. And it's gone from this small amount of protein to, you know, the recommendation is that you have a fairly big chunk of protein every day to replace what your body's breaking down.
Yes.
So how do I find out where the real answer is on that?
Yeah, let me just build on that a little bit, because the movie, there's a documentary that came out recently called The Game Changer. A lot of people may have heard of it. So I wrote a piece sort of about pros and cons in that movie. So that movie, you know, a lot of people on the one hand were calling it vegan propaganda and sort of dismissing it because they knew there was an agenda behind that to promote a plant-based diet, which tends to be a little lower in protein than an animal diet. Now, that movie, in my review, you know, it does make some really valid points, but it also exemplifies some of these sort of poor scientific practices. So, but some of the great points I think it makes, number one, the one you mentioned, that we have been led to believe that we need a lot more protein than we actually do. And the movie did a great job of showcasing, you know, athletes that do great on a plant-based diet and they're eating probably not as much protein as your average American. The second point they make is that a lot of our perceptions about needs have been influenced by the dairy industry and the meat industry. And if you go and look at scientific publications, you know, in support of, if you ask the question to you know, PubMed, my place to do, the place that scientists do their research, is you ask, you know, if you look for papers on how much protein do we need, a lot of the papers that make the point that you need more are funded by the Cattlemen's Association, or, you know, benefits and, you know, pros and cons of dairy, a lot of them are going to be funded by the dairy industry. But that it doesn't mean the if you see that funding, I would say just you be aware of it. I don't dismiss every article that I see from funded by dairy. I just have to look. Once I know, for example, that a study on the benefits of dairy is funded by the dairy industry, I'm just going to look at that with an extra critical eye on what are the ways that they design the study and what are the ways that they did their statistical analysis to try to reach the conclusion they were looking for? And are there any flaws? There may not be, but you need to be aware that they probably designed the study in a way to stack the odds in their favor. And they probably, you know, they took a leap. There's always a leap that you take from the actual results to your conclusions. And they, you know, there are places where you can sort of try to twist things and, you know, sometimes you just can't when the data are so contrary to what you wanted to find. Maybe you choose not to publish it at that point. But so you just need to be aware of the biases. The same thing with a drug, with a pharmaceutical company funding a drug trial. You just have to be aware of, was the study designed in a way to stack the odds in their favor? And did they distort the statistical analysis in any way that would distort the conclusions?
Okay. Just before I follow on that, you said, where do you find this information? For those viewers, like, it was so quick, I'm like, where do you find that?
Yeah.
And I'm sure that somebody's going to be asking the same question. Where do you find that?
Yeah, so for me, if I want to answer a question, you know, is it true that dairy is good or bad, you know, for my health? I guess my first is the resource I go to is called PubMed. So it's a collection.
It's called what?
PubMed.
PubMed. P-U-B-M-E-D.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So I go to PubMed, and that's where I can search for actual scientific publications.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, in many cases, you'll only be able to read the abstract or the summary of the publication. You won't be able to read the full publication because of not every journal is open access, but you can usually find a few open access publications.
Right, you have to get into the deep web to be able to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then you can go into the study and you'll have to look at the very bottom to see who did the funding. There'll be a section on conflicts of interest, and there'll be a section on funding. And that's where you need to just look to see, and it's very fine print, just to be aware of who influenced.
Okay, so I have gone and done that kind of thing from time to time. I don't have the time to do it very often, but I start to read some of these studies, and you know, I'm probably like an awful lot of people. My eyes start to glaze over because it becomes incomprehensible to me because they're talking about basic science that I don't have as foundational knowledge.
Yeah.
So if even though I know that resource is there and I, you know, and I want to do this, I may not have the time, I may not have the understanding. So then where do I go to find trusted sources?
For me, again, if I have a question, for example, is dairy necessary for bone health or important for bone health or something like that? I'll look at, one resource would be sort of disease organizations, national disease organizations. So if it's a question about diabetes, I'll look at Diabetes Canada.
Okay.
I'll look at Diabetes US and I'll look at Diabetes UK.
Wow.
I'll look at.
To see whether or not there is an agreement.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So disease organizations are a great one. And again, if it's about bone health, I'll look for some, you know, organization related to bone health or osteoporosis or whatever condition it is, whether it's diabetes, whether it's heart disease. I always look at the disease foundations. And again, the UK tends to have really great resources. Mm-hmm. So I typically look for a UK resource as well as an American and a Canadian resource. And so I'll compare those. That's one place. If it's a disease-specific question. The second sort of bucket of information sources that I like to use are these clinical-oriented organizations. So like Mayo Clinic.
Yes.
I'll look at their page. I'll look at Harvard Health. They have, you know, great articles on a variety of very common questions.
And so, great credibility, both organizations.
Yes. I mean, yeah. Articles vary in their quality, and I wouldn't say that I could stand by every article on Mayo Clinic and every article on Harvard Health. But when you see a common opinion across, multiple of these large organizations, then that's usually my starting point. And then when I see differences in opinions, sorry, those were my two buckets. The third bucket, I would say, are these sort of public health or national health related organizations. So World Health Organization mm-hmm. will have guidelines on a lot of topics. You hear, they get in the news mm-hmm. sometimes. And also one I really like is the UK National Health Service.
Yes.
So I'll look at some of those pages as well. And that's sort of my starting point as I'm building my opinion. And then where I see controversy, that's when I go to PubMed and I start to dig deeper and say, why is there controversy and what does the science actually say?
How does this help me make more informed choices mm-hmm. about what I'm going to consume, because this is what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. What am I going to put in my body, and then what's the impact going to be? How do I know whether or not this is going to be a benefit or detrimental?
Yeah. I think it's very important to understand what your goal is, and then you can kind of build it from there. Again, if you're trying to prevent a certain condition, you should be fixating your search on that kind of that condition that you're aiming to prevent. You can't say, is dairy good or is dairy bad? When you're looking to do a scientific search and answer a question, you have to be very specific. You have to say, is milk? Because you're looking at the answer for good or bad. First of all,
right.
You need to be more specific than, is it good or bad for me? You need to talk about with respect to what condition. And second, you need to be very specific about what product. Because if I've done some research on dairy and health, and you'll see, a meta-analysis will show, on average, it doesn't really matter. But those who had yogurt tended to have better, such and such outcome. But those who had, chocolate milk didn't.
Kind of yogurt, what kind of chocolate milk?
Yeah, exactly. So you need to be very specific in your questions.
Now that we have this emerging sector in health where I can have my genome mapped, so mm-hmm. am I then able to look at what is the known reaction between whole milk versus 2% and my particular genome.
Yeah.
And then what about my microbiome? Do I need to take all of this into consideration? And how can I possibly do that?
The reality is that the information is still very incomplete. So it's still very early days. It has not been a long time that we've been able to build. We don't have large enough databases in many cases mm-hmm. to build the strong enough associations to make predictive answers. And when you talk about the predictive power of genetics, even this, we have a handful of genes where it's almost perfect. If you know someone's genotype, you know they're going to get this disease or they're not going to get this. Well, usually they are going to get this disease. Those are few and far between.
Yes.
Most of genetics is, if you have this combination of genes, your risk is higher than the average person's risk. But
that's not a guaranteed outcome, because as I understand, epigenetics then come into play and can alter outcomes based on food choices and lifestyle.
Yes, epigenetics
and so on.
Is another layer, but even independent of epigenetics, we... there's the environmental factor is such a huge one, and the microbiome. And so our ability to predict based on a genome what someone's health outcome is going to be in response to a dietary change is very weak.
Yeah. So we should maybe put that on the sidelines right
more
now.
More research is needed.
In being able to make our own individual choices. Don't get hung up on that.
Yes.
Let's start talking about
definitely. I think most of the guidelines, I think there's very little you can get from your genome that's going to radically change the way you eat, in a strongly predictive way. So I would say those tools, they can help you make a slightly more educated guess, but they cannot make, they're very, very far from perfect predictions.
What's the best feedback loop that we've got right now?
Trial and error, honestly. Yeah. I mean, I've been doing a lot of research on weight loss recently, and I love talking to people about it. And you look at weight loss studies, and you see, people are on the same diet, and one person loses, 8 pounds, another person loses 2 pounds, and some of that may have been adherence, but some of that's going to be just their physiology and what they respond to. You always hear these people that say, I tried all these diets and finally this one, the weight fell off, mm-hmm. right? Some of that is physiology and some of that is you know, sort of mental and behavioral, right. that diet fit and didn't feel hard for them, even though it was sort of an easier way for them to go about it. So there's a huge amount of inter-individual variation. I don't think we have the predictive tools. So it's unfortunately does come down to a trial error.
Okay, so one feedback mechanism that we have, and I had a fellow, Dr. Gifford Jones, who's a medical columnist. He's in his 90s now, and he wrote this wonderful book, you know, Over 90 and How to Get Here. Mm-hmm. And I went, well, what's one of the components? And he mm-hmm. said, well, weigh yourself every day. Is he right?
Yes. I've been looking at studies of weight maintenance, and so they have registries. Number one, they have registries of people who have successfully kept weight off for years, and one of the strongest predictors is, so people in that registry are far more likely than the average to weigh themselves regularly and to track what they eat and to exercise restraint.
Mm-hmm. Because they get he says, right away you get feedback yeah. that says, well, this is what the impact was of that.
Yes, yes. I mean, of course, but I love talking about scales because they also teach us about, you know, normal variation, right? So you understand that from one day to the next, you might be 2 pounds heavier or lighter, and that's just normal biological variation. And so did the diet work? You're not going to know in 2 days. You have to look at sort of the moving average over a course of weeks to see, but you can't.
Yeah.
So some people actually suggest, you know, once a week is maybe better just because you see so much daily noise, you don't want to be stressing over it. So there's not really a perfect frequency of when to weigh yourself, but.
Well, I don't know. I started to follow that advice and lost weight and kept it off. Because every day I go, whoops, I shouldn't have had that yesterday. So then I make a point of not having it today or tomorrow because I can see the impact fairly quickly.
You're right. That definitely works for a lot of people to just to rein it in quickly. I mean, I tend to be quite, on the weight front, I think that creep happens so easily that that's one strategy to rein
easily.
It in. I mean, the statistics on weight regain, I was just looking at these yesterday. On average, over a course of a year, people regain half the weight they lost.
Yeah.
And that's the norm.
Well, I believe. Okay, so that comes to another point by a past guest that I had who said, well, you know, the problem is once you hit a certain high point in your mm-hmm. body history mm-hmm. weight, that becomes your new set point. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, no. Yeah. Does this mean that my body is now driven to get back to that point? You're not so sure that you agree.
Yeah, well, the statement that he made that I mentioned to you early is that he said the set point theory is proven. And I said, I'm not so, you know, that sounds like a strong.
So here's somebody who's.
Well, I just said that sounds like a strong statement to me. Yeah. Is that true? So since our conversation, I went and did some research on that. And there is some support. I think, you know, I think it's just the difference between, you know, as scientists, we tend to not like to make very definitive, you know, this is the way it is.
Isn't that the black swan theory?
Right?
All swans are white until they're not.
Exactly. And there are always exceptions and everything. Yeah. I view things much more in shades of gray. But I would say that the support for that statement is that if you look at someone's basal metabolic needs, your metabolic needs are actually quite strongly predicted by just your weight in mm-hmm. general. So when you lose weight, your metabolism will drop because you're a smaller human being. But the question that was sort of the set point theory says that, you know, in addition, your body's going to be doing things to fight to bring you back to that weight. I mean, the thing that he said that also sounded a bit strong to me was your body remembers, you know, your weight. I don't know about that, but there is a lasting effect. So someone who weighs a given, you know, 150 pounds or what have you, that person who was always that weight is going to have a different metabolic need than someone who lost weight to get there. So the person who lost weight to get there will actually need fewer calories per day, which is just...
Than the person who had always lived at 100.
Yes, so it's a bit of a slap in the face
yes.
to the person who worked to
you
get
there. You
had
to stop eating to lose weight, and you have to continue to eat less.
Yeah, exactly. And so that person will be sitting across the table from someone who's the same size, the always thin person, and that always thin person can eat more than them and not gain weight.
Yeah.
It is...
That is unfair.
Brutal. but it's not... I mean, one of the things that I'd like to talk more about is these effect size. So you can say, yes, there is a difference, but, you know, maybe we're talking 100 calories, right? So it doesn't mean that you can't it's not livable, right? So, you know, if an average person, say a woman, we're talking, you know, an average woman, 1,800 calories a day, an average man, maybe 2,200. If it's 100 calorie difference, you know, this is not this is not night and day.
Right.
Right. It's a little penalty.
Yes.
For sure.
So one of the other things that I want to touch on before we finish, and then also let people know that you're going to start a whole series that's going to dig into this in much greater detail, that you will be hosting and have a wide range of informed and insightful guests, is something that's been in the back of my mind. Okay, if I eat certain foods, mm-hmm. the microbiome in my GI mm-hmm. is going to be one thing, and do not those organisms say, well, I want that, I want more of what allowed me to be here. Does that make it difficult because you've got these organisms that are in you mm-hmm. that are literally telling you, I want more of that? So if you want to change your diet to get healthy, do you have to recognize that there has to be a transition that's going to happen internally
yes.
as well? Or am I
yes.
making that up?
No, not at all. So your microbiome is heavily influenced by your diet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful thing. You can't change your genetics, you know, I mean, epigenetics aside. I mean, the fundamentals, you know, the biggest driver of your genomic story, I guess, you can't change. But your microbiome, you can. And diet is, you know, it's very easy. You know, for example, vegetarians versus non-vegetarians, there's a dramatic differences in diet.
Mm-hmm.
And fiber content is probably the biggest driver. And there's sort of this positive feedback loop with your microbiome. As you feed it more fiber, the organisms that use fiber for fuel will thrive. And, you know, eventually hopefully outcompete some of the ones you might not, that might not be doing
and
you
the
favors.
And so then maybe some of those cravings for the foods that you wish that you could turn your back on will fade away.
Yes. Yes. And so I'm on the microbiome front. Fiber, the relationship between the food that you eat, particularly the fiber, is one of the strongest connections to gut health.
Well, you are so remarkably informed. I can hardly wait for your series to start. Thank you very much for coming in and sharing this.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.